This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 9th of September 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 166, with me, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck.
In today's show, we'll be talking to Tom Feiling, the author of a new book looking at Colombia's turbulent journey from South American trouble hotspot to decisive player in the global economy.
And we'll look at three letters that can make a lot of difference after your name, MBA, but are they worth the effort and the money? Writer and business expert Josh Kaufman thinks not. He'll be joining us later.
Plus, we have an in-depth conversation with renowned composer Gavin Bryars. Enjoy some of Monocle's own great music and get a look ahead at the week's essential news right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
And the green light was lit then, Andrew.
Yes.
Hi, by the way.
Hello there.
Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday to you.
Steve Bloomfield ran into the studio. I think it's a phrase my mother used to use, which is a slightly archaic one, a dose of salts. He rushed in like a dose of salts.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you know?
Are you familiar with that phrase?
I'm really not, actually.
I'm going to get everyone saying it again.
I think it's like it goes through like a dose of salts. It's meant to be. Loosening up prunes.
Yeah. Running to the loo kind of territory.
I ran in like prunes.
Like a dose of salts. Whenever I think of a much needed bathroom break, I think of Steve Bloomfield. Welcome, Steve.
As entrances go.
I actually thought it was very neat and tidy to be able to get in and get it in your chair, get your headphones on without making a sound.
Well, I just thought I'd watch you through the other side of the glasses do the top bit and then come in just for this bit.
Were you out there having your Yorkshire pudding?
I was. I'm halfway through a Yorkshire pudding. I've had a bit of roast beef and I'm going to go back. But basically everyone's waiting for me.
Okay.
We're halfway through dinner through there.
Lunch.
Well, I quit dinner.
You don't? What are you...
Lunch.
Let's not get into this, exactly.
Actually, hang on, no, I don't do it. Hang on, which one's dinner?
Dinner's in...
No, school so dinners is dinner time, lunchtime.
Yeah, exactly. What we should do, we've all been doing various things this week.
Mm.
Let us not let tradition go completely aside. Andrew, you've been away. You're in Berlin, you're in Naples. How was that?
I was in Berlin for pleasure, which was amazing. It was incredibly bright blue skies. It was great. And I hired a bicycle, potted around on Sunday.
Lovely.
Went up to Auguststrasse, which is where Kimberly Bradley, a fine correspondent, lives, and hung out with her a bit, which was amazing. It's so extraordinary when you go to a city that you realise has been two cities and you just can't quite tell where they were joined up. But we did do a great thing on the Sunday. We got the bikes and we tottered along this kind of path that you can go, which goes along part of the old wall. And it was amazing to see how close buildings were in East Berlin and West Berlin, but yet they were so effective at keeping people apart. You know, people could see each other, you know, just feet away, but just couldn't get there. And there was an amazing kind of little... place where the first guy had been shot, East German had been shot by the West Germans when a teenager had swum across this canal to get to the other side. And you just realise how it wasn't that long ago when this city was just carved in two. And then I was in Naples for...
You're listening to The Urbanist with
Andrew Tuck. That was at the UN Habitat Conference in Naples, which was very nice with David Michon. But that was a very different trip.
Steve and I hung out this week.
We did.
The Paralympics, didn't we?
It was incredible.
On Wednesday morning, that was nice.
Yes. No, it was great. I've had quite a bit of Paralympic action this week. I had a night at the Athletic Stadium, which was just incredible. And the highlight, I think, was seeing, being part of an 80,000 strong crowd cheering on an Iranian athlete to gold. And it was just the sort of thing that makes the Olympics and the Paralympics so special. And just some incredible feats. And yes, Rob and I went to the swimming, Paralympic swimming. Again, some really astonishing performances.
And it was a nice thing when you kind of feel like all the sort of, you feel that it's good-natured rubbish, but it's rubbish nonetheless, this idea of kind of goodwill, Olympic goodwill. It's kind of tangible, actually, when you're there. It's really wonderful, as you know, when you went to the Olympics.
And you know more about sport than someone like me, but that stadium, do you think there's something quite amazing, the kind of acoustics of it and the sense of 80,000 people all thinking the same thing and watching that same moment? It's incredibly moving. I found it, you know, really made me quite tearful when the best moments of sport in there.
I think it's also because it's in the round, it's a bowl. You know, a lot of football stadiums are, they've got four sides. And so there's four distinct stands. This stadium is obviously, I mean, there's no stands at all. It's just one round thing. And it's just incredible watching a 1500 meter race where there's this sort of Mexican wave of noise going around the stadium as the leading pack comes towards you.
Is that a Mexican sound wave?
Yeah. You sort of start clapping like that. And well, except louder, obviously. And it's it just sort of follows it all around. It's incredible.
I think you've given us a great introduction to your segment on the show, Steve.
What, some clapping?
A little self-congratulatory clap. You're going to tell us what's happening in the week ahead, I think.
I am. Are you ready for this?
We're ready.
My breath could not be more bated, Steve.
Excellent. Good. So let's start with something that's going to happen.
Actually, can we just say, Tom Edwards normally does this and we normally boo him.
No, we don't.
No, we do. We do.
Oh, really?
We're giving him a hard time the last couple of weeks.
We made fun of him last week. I can't remember. For what?
Well, he didn't...
You talked about something boring in Vladivostok.
He talked about something boring in Vladivostok.
Some sort of like awful
It's
sort of...
APEC.
Yeah.
It's not boring. Wow. It's really interesting.
Right.
But he didn't make it sound much fun.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's just his style.
It's APEC, Rob.
Did you ask him what APEC stands
My
for?
My favourite of all the...
Pecs.
Russo-Japanese economic forums.
Let's talk about APEC, because that sort of happened. It's still actually still happening today.
No.
But you don't want to know about that, do you? No, but I do want to talk about something that's happening right now, this very second. Yanis Stonaris, who, as you know, is the Greek finance minister, has got one of those meetings right now that you really don't want to have on a Sunday. You know, you look in your schedule, you go, oh, God, I've got to
is
do
it
that.
With the CFO? It's... Because everyone dreads those meetings, don't they? Whoever you are, especially if you're Greek, I should imagine.
It's with the Greek equivalent of the CFO. It's with the heads of the EU, European Central Bank, and the IMF inspection team. Mm. So, yeah, it's like they're coming for dinner or lunch, however you describe it.
Mm.
And they're not that interested in the Yorkshire pudding.
Can I just move on.
When we introduced this bit, like the agenda at the top of Michael Weekly, it was because we thought we wanted to give it some sort of, you know, intellectual heft. Tuesday. Should we go to Tuesday?
Yes, please.
Something exciting happening on Tuesday. Although, if you didn't find APEC exciting, you might not find the World Economic Forum annual meeting of new champions exciting.
Sounds great, though. Sounds kind of like they've kind of nicked some Olympic verbiage.
It's in Tianjin, China.
Okay.
And we're going to be hearing more about it this week, because our very own Hong Kong bureau chief, Liv Lewichnik, is heading there. And she'll be able to tell us all about it probably on Tuesday. So tune in for that. I'm not going to tell you anymore now.
Okay, that's good.
It's in China. It's World Economic Forum. It's going to be interesting. Lives there. I was going to give you one more other thing as well.
No, Steve, I think we're kind of running out of time, so we've got to get our next guest in. We've got to roll him in. Talk
and
about Colombia.
Also, I have dinner to go back to.
It's lunch. Steve Bloomfield, thank you very much for looking into your news crystal ball. As the rest of South America has experienced a boom in tourism and economic growth, Colombia's story has been one of light and shade. Known historically for violent drug crime and decades of guerrilla insurgency, its recently improving reputation as an investment hub with a lowering crime rate is doing much to shake off the past.
Our first guest is Tom Feiling, a journalist determined to tell Colombia's story through its people. His new book, Short Walks from Bogota, Journeys in the New Colombia, profiles everyone from politicians to paramilitaries while staying focused on the inspiration found in everyday Colombian life. Tom, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. You come at a really interesting time for the country. Negotiations are going on finally between the FARC, this rebel group that has made Colombia seem a very dangerous place for many years. And that finally there's negotiations going on. And the economy is booming. Is that part of the reason that you were determined to go back to Colombia, because you realised that there was an interesting story developing about this country's future?
It's certainly the case that it was timely to have written this book, and perhaps there were times when people wouldn't have been so interested in Colombia. There definitely is more interest from tourists, from investors. But having said that, my interest was trying to go a little bit beyond all the stereotypes of Colombia and to cast a light on the people and the history and the nature of Colombia. Colombia is one of those countries that, almost because it's well known for drug violence and the guerrillas, people don't really ask more fundamental questions about, well, how big is it and what's there and what are the people like? So having, you know, I've known Colombia for a good 10 years or so and always found it a really intoxicating country and not much interest here. Now that's changing, so the two came together, you know, what I wanted to say and the time was right.
The book's called Short Walks from Bogotá, Tom. That's mm-hmm. kind of like a nice personable travelogue style title for the book. Does it sort of start, is that the kind of the vibe that you wanted to give, the idea of it being a personal journey through this country rather than this is the last line in the politics of Colombia?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought I could do much more than just write a book about the politics, which, you know, it's an obsessive country. The politicking in that country, you can get lost in that. You won't be seen for weeks. I thought that there was so many other things that people should know about Colombia. It's just such a wealthy country in so many ways.
Well, that's a statistic that we always get. I know you don't want to get. We don't want to talk solely about FARC and the drugs and all the rest of it. But talking about a wealthy country, 80% of the wealth owned by 10% of the population or controlled by 10% of the population, is that a brick wall that you keep on coming up against when you're trying to tell the story of a country like Colombia?
Well, I think it's quite shocking from a British perspective, from a European perspective, going to a country like Colombia that, you know, despite this civil war being fought by, you know, so-called Marxist guerrillas, it's the wealthy people of Colombia are quite shameless. In Britain, you know, you say to yourself, well, you're not going to really see rich people walking around with huge, great fur coats and shirts showing, you know, it would be regarded as a bit tacky. But quite often, I'm sure wealthy Latin Americans will hate me saying this, but to be a wealthy Latin American, there's no shame in it at all.
Is that part of being a young society? Is that part of delineating yourself away, making a show of not being from the other side of the tracks?
Yeah, it is a very divided society, like Brazil, like a lot of other Latin American countries. And that too is something that I didn't know myself, is just how unequal Colombia is. Once peace has been secured, you know, on the assumption that these talks, peace talks, succeed, the next step for Colombia is to address this terrible inequality, because you have people living in dire poverty, the elite, well, not living in dire poverty.
and that 80% of the wealth owned by 10% of the people, does a short walk from Bogota then mostly consist of hanging out with the 90% or the 10?
A little bit of both,
I've made that sound like a boring maths exam, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, once you get outside Bogota, it is a different, it's a very centralised country in a way. Having said that, I mean, you have your swish shopping malls in all the big cities, but it can be quite a disconcerting experience because there's the swish shopping mall and, you know, it's surrounded by shanty towns. You know, it's funny in that regard. But there was a Colombian friend who made that point that in Colombia we have three worlds in one. You know, we have people in Bogota who are richer than, you know, the richest people of Norway, for example. But in Norway you won't find half the population living in poverty. So it is, it's a country of extremes. Physically, it has, you know, mountains, that awe-inspiring mountains, enormous jungles, enormous rivers, and then you get this a huge, you know, mix of people and cultures in Colombia, and, you know, very regionally based as well.
But is that kind of social revolution that you're seeing happening, say, in Brazil, where there's a huge amount of people being drawn into the middle class as the economy becomes richer and becomes more organised? Are you seeing that in Colombia as well? Is there a growing middle class?
The middle class is quite big in Colombia. I think, you know, relative to, it's one of the big middle classes of Latin America. I know the Santos government is making a great play of addressing poverty and extending education, healthcare and so on, but they're starting from a low base.
Well, they have this massive land reformation program, don't they, where they're attempting to return to many displaced people parcels of land so they can return to the land, they can start farming. And this is often land that, you know, was lost because of paramilitary attacks and the need to kind of depart from certain parts of the country because it wasn't safe. It's a huge program, worth billions of dollars. When you were there, were you seeing it being effective, this kind of almost this revolution in the way land is distributed?
Well, you can certainly see a lot of goodwill and a lot of political will in Congress, you know, and Santos, President Santos, is well behind this idea of land reform, which has always been one of the key demands from the left to address, well, firstly, the fact that so many people have been violently displaced from their land, but also you have a very old-fashioned system of land ownership, again, very concentrated. And that, I think everyone acknowledges, is one of the roots of the violence in the countryside. So it all looks good on paper. The laws are being passed, a lot of goodwill, unlike in the past. In terms of what you actually see on the ground, I think people are still holding their breath and waiting to see how it goes. As I understand it, they're kind of waiting for the FARC's input, as and when peace talks happen. And the idea is once you have the FARC on board, then perhaps there'll be, there's more chance of a land reform program succeeding. But, I mean, in answer to your question, I think it's still a bit early days. And as ever in Colombia, quite often you'll find very progressive laws being passed, but somehow the punch behind them gets progressively weaker the further from Bogota you go. So it's a question as well. The bigger question in Colombia is extending legal authority, the rule of law, making sure that an end to impunity, an end to corruption.
Look, I was just going to ask you a quick question, we were talking at the top of the show that I was just at this urban forum in Naples, a giant UN Habitat conference where thousands of people attend. They've announced just this week that in 2 years' time it will be in Medellin. So they're mm-hmm. going to expect thousands of people to go to Medellin. Now, it's extraordinary that 10 years ago you'd thought, I'll pack my flak jacket. Now you're thinking, should I take linen? Mm. And that turnaround for a city like that, do you think it has lessons for other places in Latin America? You look what's happening in Mexico, a country outside of Mexico City, many parts in the north, completely overtaken by drug barons, and the idea that it's impossible to fight these gangs. Mm. But when you see what's happening in Colombia, do you think there is hope that you can fight back against that kind of tier of drug dealing?
I mean, the jury's out, I think, on the war on drugs. And certainly it's much calmer in Colombia and all the mess has moved to Mexico. But I think if you look at what happened, the Colombian end of the business gave up on the most lucrative part of it, which is smuggling the drugs into the States. They handed that part of the business to the Mexicans, reasoning that that would get the DEA off their backs. So that's where the real money is being made. That's where the real struggles are going on for control of the business. So Colombia's effectively washed its hands of it, taking a smaller cut. I mean, Colombia's still, the cocaine producer.
But an interesting debate there about whether you make drugs legal as well. Santos is quite keen on this idea of other Latin American countries legalising as well.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Because I suppose what you've seen in the Colombian situation is they've succeeded in displacing the cocaine business, or at least the violent, most lucrative part of the cocaine business. But it's been, now it's decamped to Mexico. So it's not a victory of the war on drugs. It's just the battlefield's moved. So in the long term, you have to ask yourself, what are the more rational, scientifically based, evidence-based drug policies for the future? And Santos, I think, is grasping the nettle, extending the olive branch, various other plant-based metaphors.
I like that. talking of plant-based metaphors and drug-based metaphors, we're going to have to leave it there, Tom. But I wanted to say that Metro reviewed your book, and the pull quote that your publishers have used on the cover of your book is simply extremely addictive.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I hope there's no joke in that at all.
I think
there's nothing we can extrapolate from that, I'm sure.
No.
For the time being,
just means it's a good read.
it's better than having a tour de force written for the 4 billionth time on the back of a book,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
For the time being, Tom Feiling, author of Short Walks from Bogota, Journeys in the New Colombia. Thanks for joining us on the Weekly.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And coming up next, we're going to be speaking to composer Gavin Bryars.
Marching in step with our defence-themed issue, Monocle Films reported to duty at Seer Precision. Designing groundbreaking camouflage, two Cooper Hewitt grads show how form and function can save lives.
We get a lot of people saying that they attribute their safety and sometimes their survival to multicam, specifically saying that in some instances we were caught in the open, we had no cover. We could see the enemy, we thought for sure they could see us, and somehow they didn't, and we were able to survive that engagement.
The Art of Getting Lost, a monocle.com.
And welcome back. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
To try and encapsulate the work of our next guest is a challenge. Gavin Bryars has been at the forefront of music exploration for over 40 years, from his work as an in-demand jazz bassist to working with avant-garde musical theorist John Cage and helping luminaries such as Brian Eno and Tom Waits span disciplines from chamber music to dance and the visual arts. I sat down with Gavin Bryars earlier in the week to talk about the challenges of working in and outside of the music industry. Gavin, thanks for joining us. I want to start off by asking you about the next thing you're doing in London, which is a talk at the ICA, or a conversation with at the ICA.
Yes, I'm doing a conversation with Sam Thorne. It's in the context of an exhibition of sound art, which actually ends, I think, at the end of the week when I'm talking. And it was the only time I could do it because I actually live for part of the year on the west coast of Canada, and I only got back last week. So. This was their last slot, so I took it.
But this is an exhibition that we've talked about actually previously on Monocle 24 called Soundworks. Now it's obviously great to have you as one of the sort of keynote people. Better late than never, Gavin.
You think? could have been retrospective.
Yeah, but the idea of Soundworks is quite a new thing. Well, not quite a new thing necessarily for the ICA, but to gain awareness of this idea that. That music doesn't have to be 3-minute blips on the radio, neither does it have to be a concerto. It can be sort of anything. And that mix of art and sound. Is that something that you feel that one of the genres that you fit into?
Well, I come from that world. I started out as a jazz bass player, but even when I was in university, the girls I went out with were always from art schools because they were far more interesting than the university people. And when I started actively working in music, I was in what was called experimental music, a kind of post-Cage environment, where the only place which would employ us would be an art college rather than a music college or a university or a conservatoire. And the work was not viewed as being serious. It was viewed as being perhaps even dangerous. But the art colleges were a welcoming environment. And so quite a few musicians of my generation did work in art colleges in the late 60s through to the mid-70s. And it was a place where there was a kind of a welcoming attitude, but also they could see that there was a relevance of some post-Cage music to their work. Cage had actually been the father of Fluxus in many ways, and the whole idea of the happening came from Cage. So time-based, non-visual work, like not sculpture, not painting, was something that students were doing, and we were part of that world. And I always found that the art world was aesthetically and intellectually way ahead of the music world in terms of the way they could handle ideas, the freedom of thought, the ability to move quickly and to react. I just found it a very healthy atmosphere, and so a lot of my early work does come from that world.
And I want to ask you about that thing. Music is the most abstract of all the art forms, and yet it's most people see it as tied down to being written down on a piece of paper. Was the sort of abstraction of making stuff off on the spot, was that something that was considered? Was that something that was de rigueur in those times in the late 60s and early 70s?
Well, what I was most interested in was some of the ideas in art of the time, conceptual art, where, in fact, the way something appeared, either in a gallery or wherever, was not necessarily the way one should view it. It contained ideas, and one would read long sentences written on the wall or A4 piece of paper, and one's mind created the piece of work. It's rather like Marcel Duchamp said in The Creative Act, the work of art is completed by the viewer. Until someone sees it, the work of art isn't a work of art. You can paint in isolation, but until someone has seen it, it's not a work of art. And so that idea of making something which went on in the head, not in the physical world, was something which I found in art colleges and something which I enjoyed. So that abstraction was really at the heart of what a lot of things I was doing. And in many ways, it is at the heart of what a lot of composers do. The score itself, of course, is a kind of an abstraction. It's not it's a physical piece of paper and so on, but until it becomes heard, it is not concrete.
It is the cat that, it's like the sort of, it's the cat that mouths to be let out and the cat that mouths to be let in. Does it exist in the interim? It's that kind of idea.
That's far too profound for me.
I wanted to ask you about, you used the term a post-Cage world, and we better inform our listeners what you mean by that. This is John Cage, the avant-garde composer, and talking about the ultimate abstraction, his most famous work, 433, I suppose, was that idea incarnate in the fact that you simply lift the... You open the piano case, but you don't play the keys.
Well, that was the way it was performed at its first performance in Woodstock in 1952, and it happens to be John Cage's centenary. And I did a broadcast for another radio station recently, using that kind of metaphor, as people in the House of Commons talk about the House of Lords as another place, because Cage is still viewed as a difficult and controversial figure, and he was someone who I worked with, but he was a person who, in a way, who sort of generated, a whole different way of thinking about what can be music, and also, by implication, what can be art. His classes in 1958 at the New York School for Social Research started the whole idea of the happening and the idea of fluxus. People like George Brecht, Alan Kaprow, Lamont Young were all there, and it's out of that world where you're not even sure that a work of art has happened. And Cage did say, in fact, I started my radio program from another station with Cage's words that he always likes it when you're not sure whether a piece has started or when it's ended. And that idea that you're not quite sure whether you have actually experienced anything, I always found immensely attractive. I found it in the work of George Brecht, where you weren't sure whether you had seen an artwork or was it just an object that happened to be there.
And this is something that was kind of, I suppose, is something conceptual brought on from Bertolt Brecht, in this thing of idea of being able to see the scenes shifting, be able to see the people doing their makeup in theatre. This is the kind of same thing. We don't quite know when the action on stage has started.
That's become also almost a kind of cliche now. Yeah. In some areas of theatre where you'll have, I've seen some dance performances where, you know, technicians are wandering about and eventually you realise the piece has started. But it has become, not a cliche, but it's become fairly common.
And are these ideas, these kind of very conceptual ideas that fit into certain movements, and do you think these have gone out of fashion? Do you think they might come back into fashion? In terms of the art world, sound art and things seem to have died out as the art world got incredibly commercial. Maybe it's coming back now that people can be a bit more conceptual because they're not expecting maybe to sell so much.
Well, I think there's always a problem with if your concerns are primarily commercial. It's one of the reasons why I never wanted to be a film music composer, because I didn't actually want to have to do something which was, the essence was it had to be a commercial success, otherwise it failed. I preferred to have that idea of being writing something where you are artistically free. And in doing that, you're actually living quite a dangerous life, because no one may buy the work that you do and you end up impoverished. I've been lucky that I am a full-time professional composer. That's all I do. I don't teach. I haven't for 20 years. But it's the opposite of, say, someone like Charles Ives, who in order to be conceptually free in his work, as wild as his imagination would let him, worked by day as an insurance man and developed insurance so that he didn't have to compromise his work in order to keep his family together.
And I wanted to ask you about that. That's because I think that's a very sort of interesting idea, whether we call it contemporary orchestral music or whatever we can describe your work as, Gavin. Because on the ICA's page that prefaces your conversation this week, it says the music of Gavin Bryars falls under no category, and that's a quote from Michael Ondaatje, the novelist. That must be a bit of a pain in the arse. It must be very difficult to sell.
Well, Michael's very kind, but he says it falls between categories and almost says it creates a third category, which is very flattering, because Michael's a very bright guy. It may be difficult to sell, but that's, as I say, that hasn't been my prime concern. The fact is that now I do manage to create works which do have some commercial return, not massive, but, you know, ironically, for example, one of probably my best-known piece is Jesus Blood Never Failed Me Yet, hasn't ever earned me a penny, because there was so much so many costs loaded onto the contract when it was made, I'm still minus £49,000 in royalties. So I will never get anything from that. People think, oh, he must be a rich man. He sold 250,000 copies.
I wanted to ask you about Jesus' Blood Never Fails Me. This is a piece of work that was based around a 23-second recording of a tramp singing at Waterloo Station.
It's nearer 26.
26 seconds. I'm sorry. I'm minus 3 seconds on getting that anecdote right. And I think we're going to hear a bit of it, and then we'll talk about it in a second.
Jesus' blood never failed me. Yes, never failed me. Yes, Jesus' blood never failed me. Yes, this one thing I know.
And that was an excerpt from Gavin Bryars' Jesus' Blood Never Fails Me. And Gavin is in the studio with us now. I think the last time maybe we performed that was it at the Union Chapel in Islington?
The last time in England, yes.
Yeah, right.
I performed it elsewhere. I did, actually, oddly enough, I conducted 3 performances in the same night by a Danish orchestra who bizarrely wanted to do one every hour for 3 hours.
What's the thinking behind that?
Not sure, but I was kind and thought the orchestral musicians might find that a bit tough. So I did one version for strings and harp, another version for winds and percussion, and then one for full orchestra. So everyone only got to play it twice rather than 3 times.
Got switched up a bit.
They could have an hour off. Yeah.
And then you worked with Tom Waits as well on sort of adding... some people seem that Tom Waits sounds a bit like a drunk singing at Waterloo Station.
He's a very intelligent man,
but his signature style sort of that was a semi-commercial success as well. That's very much that's sort of the number one hit when you Google Gavin Bryars, for example. What's it like working, across genres and working with someone that's better known is defined by being in the rock genre?
I find it always interesting to collaborate with people from outside music or even people within music. So I enjoy, for example, working with dance companies, with Merce Cunningham, with lots of different companies. I enjoy working with particular musicians, but also visual artists, because you're always drawn outside yourself. There's someone else to consider. It's rather like having a family. You know, it's not just you anymore. And also they have values and ideas which may not be the ones that you would have instinctively. So it always produces at least some sort of frisson which can generate something different. So working with Tom, who is notionally from the pop world, but I think it's a particular area of pop, which one would hardly call it pop. It's not rock either. It is a kind of vernacular music, rather like jazz is a vernacular music. But it's in many ways, for me, Tom is an art music singer. He's a great poet. His libretti, his words are wonderful, and obviously a very charismatic performer. But I have a band. I have a band called Mercy and Grand, which is where we perform the music of Tom Waits, set up by Opera North, but with a classical English mezzo-soprano, Jess Walker. And now you can hear the music without Tom's voice. You hear this woman singing these songs with very clear, very audibly English diction. Yet then you hear how great the music is. And working with Tom was terrific. We spent a day together, basically. We'd been in touch for some years before. He originally got in touch with me in the 80s because he'd lost his recording, his vinyl recording of the original version recorded in 1975. And it apparently was his favourite record, which is very high praise. And he just wondered if I still had one. And I happened to have one, so I let him have it. And we stayed in touch, and then... I actually had an idea of having Tom in my second opera, ENO, Dr. Ox's experiment, and he was interested in that. In the end, we had a classical tenor, but the idea of having someone who was from another world on the stage was interesting. But in the middle of this, I was remaking Jesus Blood Never Failed Me Yet for Philip Glass's label, and I had the idea of adding Tom to this, and so we spent a day in Northern California, working together, just the two of us and his engineer in the studio, and it was probably one of the most enjoyable musical days I've had in my life. It was terrific. Wonderful man. We got on very well and just had a wonderful day.
And I presume also for him, working with the man that made his favourite record is a great thing, but also it must be nice for singers to... for him to be a singer on that record rather than have to provide the words as
yes.
well. So it must set you free as a performer, I guess.
It set him very free. In fact, ironically, although he was singing along with the old man, he never once got it right. We recorded for about 45, yeah. maybe about 45 minutes in total, in several 15-minute sections, maybe an hour, but never once did he sing it exactly correct. He either just left out a note here and there or altered the phrase, but that's fine.
Which I guess is that wavering off the
score. Well, it's rather like, you know, yeah. Frank Sinatra, you know, crooner, yeah. you can move away, there's a certain freedom, and it's authentic and it's thoroughly artistic.
And that was I Have Heard It Said That a Spirit Enters, composed by Gavin Bryars and performed by the CBC Radio Orchestra with Owen Underhill conducting and Holly Cole as the featured vocalist. And he'll be in conversation with Sam Thorne from Freeze magazine about his work at the ICA in London on the 11th of September. He was a pretty cool guy. We sort of turned the mics off and then we had a massive chat about cricket. I noticed one sort of word on his T-shirt.
Which was the one word on his T-shirt?
Which was cricket, which was some sort of quote from something by C.B. Fry. And then we had quite a decent thing. I think we could get him on as a sports pundit, the most unusual of all sports pundits on Monocle 24, Andrew.
He wasn't one of those annoying people, though, that told you the most interesting things as soon as you turned the microphone off.
No, he didn't. I think he's kind of used to... I don't think he's used to doing his thing. I think he's used to sort of talking about his music. But it's nice to get someone that... kind of works in a sort of ethereal world, but can explain it quite neatly as well.
You've had some legends through here in the last few weeks.
Yeah. Andrew Tuck.
Yes, I've been here.
You name him. You name him. it's been good. We've had some good times.
Okay, well, I think enough of that. Anyway, you're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
We're going to get some music now.
Oh, what have you got, Rob?
We're going to... the friend of Monocle, Tim Burgess, he's coming in for a session next week, a Midori House session. Thought we'd sort of prep our audience and possibly a few of the people in the building. He was the man that was the front man of the Charlatans, of course. He wrote a very good memoir. A lot of it contained a lot of Colombian marching powder, in fact. That was a lot of analogous stuff to extremely addictive. And this is a track called White from his new record, Oh No, I Love You. And that from the new record, Oh No, I Love You, was White by Tim Burgess.
Figures published this week show that just 40% of America's top CEOs hold an MBA qualification. That's Master of Business Administration, for those listeners already staring idly out of the classroom window. The recent financial downturn has pushed entrepreneurs to cut class and innovate. So, is the MBA a thing of the past? Our final guest, Josh Kaufman, author of The Personal MBA, has long been an advocate of doing things your own way. Josh, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks for having me.
We have a little kind of business regular in the Monocle, which asks CEOs to kind of guide us through their management technique. And we have a little Q&A at the end of it. And one of the two things is, one of the questions we ask is, what's best, to learn on the job or have an MBA? And I'd say in the 2 years we've run it, every single person has said to learn on the job. So where has this mystique about the MBA come from?
I think MBA programs have done a really tremendous job over the past several decades of marketing the value of the program. But for the vast majority of individuals, the value is actually in learning how businesses work and learning how to think through a business and make better decisions. And that's something you can do by yourself. You don't necessarily have to go through an MBA program to get that knowledge or to get that experience. So I think a combination of learning business on your own and then going out into the real world and trying new things to see what works and what doesn't ends up being a much faster and more valuable way to get the business experience that you
But
need.
You're not saying that you know, studying business or learning about business is wrong, because in a way your book, The Personal MBA, there's quite a lot to study in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what is it about the formalized MBA that you think, you know, isn't quite correct for everybody?
Yeah, I think the formal MBA isn't quite correct because it is tremendously expensive, both in terms of...
How much is an MBA, by the way? I didn't...
In the UK, I think most programs are somewhere between £45,000 and £50,000 a year. In the US, there was actually a study done by John Byrne, who is a contributor for Fortune magazine. And when you add up tuition, opportunity cost, lost wages, living expenses, everything that you end up paying or giving up to go through an MBA program for 2 years in the US, the top 10 schools are over $300,000 over the course of about 2 years. So it's a tremendous investment of upfront time and energy and money, which, when all is said and done, can get you an interview for, you know, let's say a large investment bank or a large consulting firm. But if you're a creative person or a programmer or an artist or someone who runs a business or is involved in a business, you don't need to buy that very expensive interview. All you really need to do is learn the fundamentals of business in a way that helps you do your job better. And you can do that without spending a lot of time, without spending a lot of money, just by learning the very most important concepts in the field.
Now, you run a very successful website where people come to learn some of these skills. Just tell us a little bit of your personal history. How did you come to be an authority on how to run a business?
Sure. I actually, just out of high school, I started my own business. So I started designing websites, doing the programming, doing the design, things like that. So I was running one of the smallest businesses in the world. And then after college, I had the opportunity to intern for a very large company, Procter & Gamble. And that internship led to a full-time job. And I was still doing the web design stuff on the side. So I had this really interesting experience of simultaneously working for one of the largest companies in the world and one of the smallest companies in the world. And when I decided I wanted to get more serious about learning more about business, I wanted to find the things that were applicable to both. So the concepts, the ideas, the practices that were genuinely useful, whether you were running a super large business or a really small one. And so that's when I started reading and researching. And I've spent about 10 years. I've read thousands of business books trying to learn all of this for myself. And the Personal MBA is a collection of the most important ideas that just kept coming up over and over and over again, which is a really good indication that they're important. So I decided to put them all in one book instead of having people read thousands and thousands to get the good stuff.
I wanted to ask you, it seems like sort of getting an MBA seems a bit like a sort of creative writing course. Mm-hmm. I tend to feel you can kind of either do it or you can't. Lots of people probably feel the same. And
but you stuck with it, Rob.
What?
You stuck with it despite all that.
Despite what?
Well, you can either do it or you can't.
It's true though, right? I always kind of feel like the MBA... kind of feels like it's sort of designed for people that want to sort of become absorbed into some huge machine as a cog in it. I mean, how many real entrepreneurs possibly, or kind of businessmen, business people, kind of, you know, that with recognizable hunger and fresh ideas kind of get an MBA? It doesn't seem to me to be something that they do.
Yeah, I think even if you have people who are really hungry to go out there and do something, I think the MBA is actually an active barrier to that, right? Because if you've taken on this huge debt to get this degree or get this credential, you have to be able to make enough money pretty much immediately to start paying back that debt. And so when you're really encumbered with this big amount of money that you need to pay, you almost have to go to work for a big company or a large consulting firm just to be able to pay it back. A few years ago, actually right after the first edition of the book came out, can't make this up, I was in New York and I was riding the subway back to the airport, and I was next to a woman who had just graduated from Harvard Business School. And we got to talking because I was curious about her experience. And her goal was to work for nonprofits and some agencies in developing markets. That's what she wanted to do. And she thought the degree was going to be the vehicle that would help her get an in to some of these organizations. I asked her what she was actually doing or what she was doing after graduation, and she was moving to San Francisco to work for a large consulting company because that was the only opportunity that would pay her enough to pay off her loans. And I think that's really sad. You take a person who is very dedicated and very motivated, and you encumber them with this debt that really limits their options to go out and do what they want to do. I think it's far more effective to just learn the basics of how businesses actually work and then just get started.
That's the sell.
That's the sell. We've got that.
I thought that was Winnie the Pooh.
You're persuasive. Can I presume that alongside this, that is your business public speaking? Is your business?
No, it's not. It's actually business advising.
Okay.
So I do a combination of writing training materials like the personal MBA and producing some online course type things. But I also work with individual entrepreneurs all over the world. So I usually work with earlier stage companies that are in the idea phase and trying to find a business model that works. And I work directly with the founders to help them make sure they're thinking about the most important things and then test new ideas as quickly and inexpensively as possible to see what works and to eliminate what doesn't.
Can I quickly, two pet bugs about kind of most people going to business these days. One, they want to make a huge amount of money.
Yep.
And that, you know, that the San Francisco model of making money, that you really don't invest in anything unless you're going to make, you know, a billion, and you'll make it by the time you're 25 and then you're going to get out.
Right.
And the other thing is that exit strategy. I find it so depressing every time you meet people with this amazing idea and you say, and then what will you do after that? My plan is to sell it in 3 years, in four years, in 5 years. Does that depress you that there's so little commitment to running a business? There's no kind of idea these days of setting up a family business, of setting up something that will employ your cousins and your nephews. That idea of business as part of a neighborhood, of
you talk about the mafia.
Yeah, partly. But it is. It's just gone. Everyone wants the quick in and the quick out.
Yes. And personally, I'm a huge fan of the craftsman style business, where you find some area of life or commerce that you care very intensely about, and you go about setting up a business to both sustain yourself doing something you really enjoy and in a way that makes your customers much better off because you exist. I really don't like the whole style of build something, make it big, sell it, and get out as quickly as possible. And I think it's what's really nice now is, in the grand scheme of human history, it is easier to start and run a business now than it ever has been in the history of the world. And so being able to decide what you want to do and how you want to spend your days, and being able to set up a structure that supports yourself doing something that you enjoy and to keep doing it for as long as you care to do it, I think that's a really great thing. And, you know, the definition of business success as whatever is sufficient enough to make it worth your while to keep going. Once you reach that standpoint, or once you reach that level, you can start making decisions however you want. So, for example, my wife Kelsey and I both run businesses, and we run it from home. And personally, there are a lot of decisions that I could make that would result in my business becoming much bigger. But personally, I value spending time at home with my daughter Lila above and beyond making the business bigger. And we're beyond the point of sufficiency, so it's easier to make the trade-off and say, I am choosing not to do these things because I want to be at home with my wife and kids. And that's, once you reach the point of sufficiency, that's a perfectly valid business decision.
for the time, we'll have to see if whether making a living or making a killing is enough. Maybe that answer is available in the pages of The Personal MBA, written by Josh Kaufman. Thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
Thanks for having me.
Which brings us to the end. I'll get near the microphone. It's traditional, isn't it?
I think the guest chair needs some oil on it. You've noticed it's squeaking a little bit.
That was my pen.
Oh, was it your pen?
Yeah. I keep on doing and undoing. I haven't bought one of these pens since like prep school. I thought I'd have a little brand.
You don't like the stationery anymore?
I like those fountain pens that we don't seem to get anymore.
No, Tyler doesn't like them.
What did you enjoy episode 166 of the Monocle Weekly?
I did. Very different guests. Tom Filing.
Yep.
Casual, laid back.
Yeah.
Josh, he's on the money.
He was a go-getting man with a gold cover for his book, wasn't he?
Yes.
In very many ways. And Gavin Bryars, well, it's great to meet legends like that who are sort of generous with their time and their knowledge. So it was cool.
I think we hit every note in this show.
And we had little Stevie B at the beginning.
Little Stevie B.
But for the time being, we should thank our producer, Paul Noble.
Thank you, Paul.
And Tom Hall, who helped out as well.
Thank you,
Tom. Researcher. And for the time being, for me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.